Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, which I did for NPR and KCRW in Santa Monica and so forth for about 6 years. And then in the age of Trump, NPR got a little bit more cautious, I guess is the right word. So I still do it with SharePost, and it's out, you know, on Spotify, Apple, all these places you can hear a podcast. But I want to talk really about a media story involving Jeffrey Epstein and the whole scandal and everything, where the guy who's an expert on media, he puts out the Gaslight Gazette. I know him through Project Censored. He's a lecturer at the University of California at Santa Cruz, a media and a critical media literary scholar. And what I want to get at is to what is the there in the Jeffrey Epstein thing? And my own feeling is it's turning out to be far more important than simply gossip and scandal and an inconvenience for, you know, pompous people like Lauren Summers and maybe Clinton and maybe Trump himself. But maybe it is a real insight into the profound corruption of American society. And I want to pick up one angle in connection with the Lauren Summers revelation, because here is a guy who got away. Lauren Summers, for people who don't know him, was a well-known economist, and he became Treasury Secretary in Bill Clinton's administration and was involved with Obama's administration. And in between, he did consulting for Wall Street and was rewarded for basically unleashing the gates of corruption on Wall Street, ending the New Deal regulations, basically destroying what was the best about the Democratic Party's flirtation with sincere liberalism and, you know, and recognizing the plight of ordinary folks and joining the elite. And he was the head of Harvard. Now he's been forced to step down from Harvard because of his name being linked with Epstein, as being close to him even after he had been convicted of crimes and so forth. But I want to get at the whole notion of this responsible elite in our society. Whether they're Republican or Democrat, they told us they were the adults watching the store. They were responsible people. They cared about ordinary people. We knew they were elitists. We knew they cherished their snobbish credentials. But we assumed that deep down, they had some feeling for the American people. And what this has revealed is like they're a kind of a heartless gang of opportunists who are just looking out for themselves, their pleasures, their money. There's a stink to this that extends to an essential critique of our culture and our society. So you've spent a lot of time on the revelations that have come out. How do you see it? And am I exaggerating or what?
No, Bob, I think you're spot on, and thank you for having me today. It's a pleasure to talk to you. And a few of the things you said there, I think, are really important for setting any conversation about Epstein. Anybody interested in having a team red versus team blue analysis of Epstein is not going to get anywhere with the story. Anyone who reduces this to just a story of victims and Epstein, I don't think is going to get to the heart of the story. And I think this has been one of the issues that news media have largely had with this story in the United States. They've generally dismissed it as a bunch of conspiratorial thinking. As more evidence emerged, they try to talk about it in the hyper-partisan frame of Democrats versus Republicans. And now they're trying to talk about it in this frame of, you know, getting justice for the victims, which I want to, you know, reiterate, this is really important. These are children who are victims of Epstein's crimes. But they seem to conveniently keep dancing around this other part of it, which I think you spoke to there by talking about elites. They seem uncomfortable with asking questions about how Epstein got this access to power, what he was doing with these folks in power. I heard Abby Phillips on CNN refer to him as like an information collector, as if he's some lone wolf who's going around like a journalist and collecting information and leveraging powerful people. It seems like there's a lot more to this story. The emails and documentation that have come out thus far show someone who not only was connected to people in power, but was doing favors for people in power, you know, particularly the United States government, the Israeli government, and possibly the Russian government in some of these emails as well. And I think that's the much larger story, is what was Jeffrey Epstein doing on behalf of these interests? Because whatever he was doing, it seems like this engagement in pedophilia and potentially blackmail or character assassination was a part of that larger effort. And the news media has largely just kind of dismissed that as a conspiracy, even though as more and more of these documents and emails come out, it seems very clear that Epstein was doing more than just trafficking children and sex victims.
Well, what was he doing?
You know, it's difficult to say. You know, we know that he was brokering some intelligence deals, particularly for Israel. These included advocating on behalf of Israel for agreements in Mongolia. We know that in some of the emails, he claims to be giving dirt on Donald Trump to the nation of Russia. We know that he got his start from Bill Barr's father, who came from the OSS, which was the predecessor to the CIA. When I say his start, Jeffrey Epstein was able to teach at this very elite preparatory school called the Dalton School, where Barr's father was in charge of. And so we see these connections and discussions of distributing information and doing actions on behalf of other governments. But the news media doesn't seem to want to connect the dots. They act as if he's just some lone wolf who happened to have these connections.
Yeah, I mean, what I want to get at is he seems to have been the glue that networked these people. I mean, first of all, beginning, I don't know, I guess with the money with Victoria's Secret and all that, he was actually a prophet of the new capitalism, or the new Democrats' capitalism, of the unregulated Wall Street. He seemed to know where you should place your bets and who are the people to talk to. That's often left out of the discussion. But here's Lawrence Summers, who, you know, destroyed Brooksley Bourne. For people who don't know Brooksley Bourne, she's the one person in the Clinton administration, maybe Robert Reich is another, who understood just how evil this stuff was, the regulating Wall Street. She, you know, been the head of her law school class at Stanford. She worked for big banks. She's the one really who understood what all these derivatives were, collateralized debt obligations and all that. And she warned about it. She got this sort of lesser appointment. Some people thought she would be Attorney General instead of Janet Reno, but she got the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. And she, well, Warren Buffett also sounded alarm about these financial means of mass destruction, but Brooksley Bourne really knew how they worked. And she called it out, and she then got in the crosshairs of Lawrence Summers and passed a monumental piece of legislation called the Commodity Futures Trade Modernization Act, which let them do whatever they want. And there was Lawrence Summers testifying before Congress. They know what they're doing. They're responsible. You're going to mess it up. And Brooksley Bourne, with her call for regulation or restoring New Deal regulation, she's going to destroy this thing that we really need to be competitive in the world. And this guy not only getting advice about his love life, but at the same time as he wants advice about how to keep his mistress or some person happy, he's also wants $1 million to keep his wife happy in some research project at Harvard or something. I mean, when I use the word glue, they all seem happy, like they went to summer camp together on the Lolita Express. You know, they liked hanging out with this guy, and they brought him in to like Harvard. Oh, you can have an office here. I mean, what do you bring a predator into a college campus? Oh, yeah. And they just like, I guess if we're going to have an old boys network, this seems to have been the Jeffrey Epstein network. So what did he do for them? And, you know, in some sense, it was kind of it was a window to a capitalism that they thought was fun, that they could enjoy. He threw a lot of money around. But, you know, and you went through one reason I wanted to talk to you. You've done some very good cataloging of everything we've learned. And I forget where I read these articles. Maybe it was on your website. But why don't you take us through it? What was this gang of bipartisan, powerful people, you know, what does it say about the meritocracy that they welcomed him into.
Yeah, and I think, you know, your question gets to one of the big problems that a lot of elites, certainly here in the United States, are now facing, because, you know, Jeffrey Epstein's sex crimes came to light in 2007, 2008, when he received what many have called the so-called sweetheart deal. He basically got a slap on the wrist while facing all these accusations in Florida of sex trafficking and sexual assault. And I think that's important to remember, because today we're going to talk a lot about folks who stayed in touch with Jeffrey Epstein after that. So after it was known that he had committed these crimes, they were willing to engage with him. But the excuse from folks, elites, has largely been that Jeffrey Epstein was introduced as someone who could provide financial advice. And they claimed that their relationships with him were purely financial. And this is, you know, again, across the ideological spectrum, from, you know, Democrats and Republicans, from Larry Summers types, even Noam Chomsky types, have had these contacts with Jeffrey Epstein. But, you know, what was always kind of curious to a lot of people who study Jeffrey Epstein was, well, how did he become a financial expert? There's nothing in his background. You know, prior to being treated like this financial expert, again, he taught at this preparatory school, the Dalton School, where he was connected to powerful people in finance, but it wasn't clear that he had any, you know, skills in the industry. And yet very wealthy people like Les Wexner, who's a major investor, you know, gave a Manhattan apartment to Epstein.
The Victoria's Secret guy.
Right. And gave him a place to live in Manhattan. It was worth millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars. And so there's never really been an explanation of what those relationships looked like. But along the way, you know, we have some various pieces that folks have tried to piece together. And I mentioned one earlier about how he got the job at Dalton from Bill Barr's father, who was formerly OSS and intelligence. At the same time, there were rumors that, you know, some of the people that Epstein was connected to were compromised. Bill Clinton was one of them, particularly when Bill Clinton was trying to negotiate between the Palestinians and Israel during his presidency. There was a lot of rumors at the time that the Lewinsky scandal had been brought to the attention of Israel long before the American public, and that was somehow used against him. And for folks who don't remember, that was also a time when third party candidate Ross Perot was surging in the polls for president, and all of a sudden dropped out, and later on said that he had been blackmailed by intelligence, and that's why he dropped out of the race. So these were kind of the questions that were streaming around, and then in the age of the internet, they were asked, you know, more and more. And the news media largely kind of went with that Epstein was just this kind of shadowy character who gave financial advice to the elites, and he had this dark sex trafficking side, and that's it. There's nothing more to the story. Don't ask any questions. And there were journalists who did ask questions, like Amy Rohrbach is a famous example. She claims that she had some evidence connecting Epstein to larger crimes, and that he ABC killed her reporting. That's who she worked for at the time. And there were folks like Julie K. Brown, who was a fearless reporter from Florida, who continued to follow the Jeffrey Epstein story and, you know, point out these connections he had and the inconsistencies in some of the narratives around Epstein. And a lot of people online, you know, really wanted to know more information about this. Why did Epstein get off with a slap on the wrist, given all these like larger questions? And of course, he ended up finally getting arrested during Donald Trump's first term, and then was found hanging dead in his jail cell, to which it was reported that he had committed suicide. And he was supposedly on suicide watch. There was supposedly a camera facing the cell. And in the years since, the government has gone back and forth about whether or not the cameras malfunctioned or whether or not they were on. They released camera footage during the second Trump term, but then CBS reporting showed that those cameras were actually the wrong floor, and the cameras that were shown were missing a minute of footage. So these questions have persisted, and the document dumps really fight back against that story that Epstein was just some kind of friend of the wealthy giving financial advice. We see that, no, he was, you know, brokering deals, international agreements on behalf of Israel. He was trading dirt on certain people, particularly Donald Trump, to Russia. And Epstein had made these larger connections where people would come to him for advice and information on other people. Most famously, the representative from the Virgin Islands in Congress, Stacey Plaskett, who was his representative at the time, was live texting with Jeffrey Epstein while she was interviewing Michael Cohen during a Michael Cohen congressional hearing during Trump's first administration. So the whole story we've been told about Epstein is not really supported by this documentation. It's a lot more complicated, and it shows a much more complex figure with further reach each time more of these documents come out. And we have to remember, we're only seeing a little slice of what's out there. And if the Trump administration goes through with this new bill it signed, it already sounds like they're filtering out certain information. So we're going to continue only to get pieces of the story as we try and figure out this larger picture of who Jeffrey Epstein was and what his larger purpose was. But it's very clear he was not just some financial advisor. He was much more than that.
What I want to get at is I'm less interested in who Jeffrey Epstein was rather than what the system is that he was could be so central to. And it's not like he's just, you know, there are pimps that can get you whatever sexual excitement you want and without being invited to have an office at Harvard or being expected to be big donors. He didn't have that much money so that he could just buy his way. And that's why I use this concept of the glue. I mean, after all, there's a social glue in any situation. There's the apparatchik in Russia, and it's under Stalin. There's who are the players and so forth. And for capitalism, there's always been the fantasy of the invisible hand of Adam Smith, of a market, right? And, you know, people who relate because they look at profit, they look at figures, they maximize the opportunity and so forth. That world never really existed because capitalism was the plaything of kings and, you know, other people of power. You had, you know, the American Revolution was fought against the British Tea Party and as an extension and so forth. But there was at least a sense going up through the robber barons and all those folks and even into the Rockefeller brothers and so forth, that they were focused on the bottom line. They were focused on maximizing profit, right? What we've seen, and I have to credit Oliver Stone with his original movie, Wall Street. We saw the culture of corruption that is the glue, the use of drugs, the use of sex. Yes, I want the money, but I want the money so I'll have power over other people. I can exploit young women, you know, which is the case here. And I don't think you can separate the decadence from the appeal of someone. That is the MO that he's selling. You know, they had to know. They called it the Lolita Express. They had to know they were, that's why I used the sort of degenerate gang of guys. You know, we're into something here. And there was this, you know, we saw it in the other movies that came out, The Wolf of Wall Street, and I forget all their names, but they all capture that. And Inside Job, which is a terrific documentary on all this, the corruption was central to the operation. And after all, when they said he knew a lot about finance, that has nothing to do with econometrics and really figuring out profit maximization and supply chains and all this stuff. That has to be lying. It has to be manipulating people. It has to have the aura of success, which is, after all, what collateralized debt obligations were, credit default, phony insurance policies, phony valuations, lumping things together and then selling them as something different than what they were. So scamming was really central to the enterprise. And I think the big story here, Rez, is that ideology of his, or psychology, or whatever it was, provided a sense of we are modern. Both of the pieces of legislation, the Financial Services Modernization Act and the the Commodity Futures Modernization, stress the modernization. The New Deal was old-fashioned. The old economy of labor unions and fighting for workers' rights, and, you know, how do you spread it around more? That's old-fashioned. We're now in a new world combined with the internet, right, where all that matters is who you know, where you're placed, who you can rip off, how you can con, and he was central to the con. He was hip. He knew sexy people. He could have fun. It's like I once went, not that long ago, to the Bohemian Grove, but there were still the Bushes were there and everything. Somebody had invited me, and I that was what it was. It was, you know, a decadence festival. But at least in the older days, they thought maybe they still brought in prostitutes, but they thought we can't be too blatant here, and we certainly can't go for hard drugs or anything. But now, in this new world of, and let's use the labels, New Democrats, the Clintonites, and so forth, which Lawrence Summers was the quintessential New Democrat, right?
Yeah.
The decadence was the glue. That's what gave it. And that also gave you the haze where you didn't have to think too long. Well, the guy's a pervert. You know, the guy's done this. It's terrible. The 14-year-old girls get, you know, this is evil. No, it's not evil. It's part of an atmosphere of delightful corruption, almost. You know, it's exciting. We're young again, you know. And I think it requires a cultural critique.
I completely agree. And that's something that really comes through in the documents that have been released thus far, that a lot of what you mentioned there, just this type of sexualization of children, for example, is just part of the culture. I mean, even Donald Trump publicly years ago said, like, Jeffrey likes them young. And you can see in the birthday book that was released to Jeffrey Epstein, it's openly talked about because it's an open secret. It's so normalized in the culture that no one seems to have a distaste for it. And even after he's caught for it, folks continue to work with him. And to your point about the 1990s and the New Democrats, you know, it's also important to say that the end of the Cold War, what we deemed the end of the Cold War in 1991, that was also used as a justification that we needed this quote unquote New World Order. And that's further extended after 9/11, that we're in a new era. But in both cases, it was the idea that we need to throw out the old, an excuse to throw out the old. And part of that, it was really an opportunity for capital in major ways, right? They had a certain control over the American mind that they had not had during the Cold War. And I think this is kind of one of the mistakes some like left critics make of capital. They immediately say, you know, we should abolish billionaires, but they don't say why. And I think one of the major reasons is exactly what you just talked about. Money is power. You can buy that influence. Whether or not Jeffrey Epstein was the only person going around collecting dirt that was used to leverage against people like Brooksley Bourne remains to be seen. But if you have billions or trillions of dollars, you can buy many of these, you know, Jeffrey Epstein-like characters who can collect information, who can leverage people that are actually trying to make the system work for working people and get them out of the way. And that appears to be what's indicated in a lot of these email exchanges, is that money and power, you know, was able to use someone like Epstein to leverage the system for their own advantage. And to your point about Larry Summers, I think it's no surprise that the Larry Summers, New Democrats types found a way to sell this as some cultural progress, right? They wrapped it in, you know, we're the cool liberals, you know, we support feminism. We're going to put RBG on the Supreme Court. You know, we don't care about race anymore. We're not going to talk about that nonsense. But their actual agenda in Congress was deregulating a lot of things that were put in place to create a more fairer economy in a capitalist setting for working people so they could get more wealth for themselves. And also keep themselves from any accountability or responsibility from the damage they cause, whether it be economic or cultural, right? And this is another part of the Jeffrey Epstein story is when he gets that sweetheart deal, Alex Acosta, you know, he continues to have very powerful positions in government up through the first Trump administration. So people are rewarded who take part of this and support this system, where people who come out and, you know, go against what capital are doing, such as Brooksley Bourne, they get really kind of sidelined to the shadows. It's scholars who document them, and that's about it.
They tried to destroy her. And, yeah. And it was all of them, Greenspan and Summers, you know. I want to get it back to the decadence of the culture, which is the glue, because it's like being an alcoholic or a drug addict of some kind or other. It lets you forget inconvenient facts, morality, who's getting hurt, that there are really human beings. This 14-year-old is a human being. You know, what are we doing here? And it becomes the rationalization, really, is this is just the way life is, the way the world is. Get with it, you know, so have a line of Coke or something, or let's just get excited about sex. You know, again, I mean, right? Then it's, you know, because the connection between power and sex, now we have a more sophisticated way of doing it, you know? And he, I think he was more than just a convenient fixer. By all accounts, he was quite persuasive, persuasive, and you know, he was proud of his, even his smile. You know, it's like, we're in. This is the new thing. We're winners, and we are enlightened. And ironically, they would even pretend, you know, to be pro-feminist, even though Lawrence Summers was the one who said women can't get, you know, do mathematics and science, so get used to it. And he destroyed this woman, Brooksley Bourne, using, well, what does she know? She's a woman, you know. But I want to... And we only have a few more minutes if we stick to the 30 minutes. But the idea of the glue, because these people had other ways to spend their time. You know, they could design their own vacations. They can have their own jet planes. They didn't need his plane, right? And I'm sure as more and more comes out, including the stuff that's redacted and everything, we'll get to it. But I think it will give us an insight into the decline of Rome, the American Rome, that we really haven't considered. We've always put it in sort of straight terms, like we're dealing with basically solid people who've gone awry or do the wrong thing or so forth. Here we're experiencing, you know, Caligula or something. It was deliberate embrace of decadence, you know. And they got hooked on it because they had to know while it was going on, this is ultimately going to hurt me. That's the whole thing about addiction. They got addicted to it. Bill Clinton got addicted to it. And he even so warned Bill Clinton, who had his relation to women and, you know, sex and everything has been this glaring headlight to him, you know, and yet there he is at it again, you know, to the end.
Yeah, and I think there what you're saying is supported in the documents as well. I mean, because one of the things that really comes out about Jeffrey Epstein is his hubris. He really likes the attention. He really likes to brag and flaunt his power and influence. And then the people who are communicating with him, it seems like there's kind of two driving reasons. One, we've talked a lot about that they saw him as a fixer, someone who could get him the information they need. But the other one talks to this point that you're mentioning about decadence, which is they're so impressed at his ability to connect with these wealthy and powerful people, to bring them to these impressive places like, you know, Buckingham Palace or these islands or meet with these huge figures, right? I was just reading some of the communications that Chomsky and his wife had with Epstein. And Chomsky's, you know, bragging about how Epstein can just get like leaders in Norway on the phone. And Chomsky thought that was like so cool. And I think it speaks to that, you know, decadence culture you're talking about.
You said Chomsky or Trump?
Noam Chomsky. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, tell me more about this. Cause I've got respect for Chomsky and all that. And I just wondered what is he doing here in these?
Me too. And, you know, as a media scholar myself, Chomsky is a major influence and someone who's, you know, endorsed books of mine, things like that. Chomsky, about 2 years ago, it first came out that he had contact with Epstein, and he sort of passed it off as this was someone he had had a dinner with and received financial advice from. But some of the recently released emails show that it was a lot more than that, that he was in contact with Epstein a lot between 2017 and maybe through 2019, but at least after 2017, because he signed his emails from Arizona State, where he had started working in 2017. And in those emails, Chomsky, you know, talks about Epstein like a friend and these different meetings they've had. And Epstein talks about how Chomsky visited Epstein's New Mexico home, which is currently a focal point of investigation for whether or not there were sex crimes there as well. This stuff is just coming out now. But yeah, that was kind of what we know about Chomsky thus far.
But yeah, I mean, it's the network. The connections, I mean, a lot of these people, you wonder, would they be in the same room were it not for this glue? That's why, to me, this is it really shows the instability of leadership in the American experience now. I mean, it's always been these kind of contradictions and madness, but this is also an example of the decadence of the best and the brightest. After all, that's a theme that I know you've dealt with, but you know, the people who have really messed up this experiment in democratic capitalism or democracy went to the best schools. They professed often the best motives. They warned us about the excess of power. They warned us about the need for separation of powers and checks and balances and transparency. And yet they are selected out, successful, and in power, turn out to be the worst actors. We're not talking about mild stuff here. You know, what the Clintons did in relation to the economy, where we now have the most extreme class divided society in the history of humanity, and three people have as much wealth as 50% of the bottom population, and those three people have that wealth because the Clinton administration, obviously supported by the Republicans, said the internet should not be regulated. They know what they're doing, right? Banking. They gave the rise of the whole financial, turn over the whole country to the financial industry. Everyone knew that it grown up in this country or and know the history, don't trust the bankers. You know, the Old Testament warns us, don't trust the bankers. Jesus warned us, don't trust the bankers. The bankers have often warned, don't trust us, right? And yet, what did they do? In the name of kind of a new democracy or new liberalism, or, you know, a neoliberalism, they said, hey, we really like these guys. They like us. They support us in our campaigns and everything. And you know what? They don't have the burden of being overtly racist or misogynist. They are in their behavior, but we can keep that behind closed doors. There's something so profoundly sick about this. What I'm trying to do is address a question you have raised. Is it worth the attention? And I'm saying this is the story that will not stop giving in terms of insight. I think this is, you can just spend the rest of your life on it. No, because it will keep revealing, you know, an ugliness, the decadence of America that will make actually the robber barons seem saintly by comparison. You know, at least there you could say, oh, I know he wants to get so much of this money, but at the end he'll put it into libraries or do the right thing or something. We had this sort of illusion about Gates and Buffett, you know, people like that, they'll give it back. These people are willing to destroy everything.
Yeah, and you know, one of the interesting authors that's helpful here is Catherine Liu from University of California, Irvine. She wrote this book called Virtue Hoarders, and she really speaks to what you're talking about there, about how these people get so high on their own power, they start to believe their own rhetoric and think they actually are the most virtuous people. So they have no problem finger wagging at others for being racist or sexist or whatever, but they totally ignore how they're engaging in the exact same behaviors they're accusing others of. And worse.
I think Richard Nixon would be so embarrassed to be involved with this. I mean, you know, and his wife would have left him, and his voters would have left him. I mean, you know, this is really going down. And the idea that people, you know, apologize, well, beginning with Monica Lewinsky with Clinton, I mean, really, the idea that they were quite willing, people even who called themselves feminists and leaders of women's, you know, it's astounding. And they're still doing it, right? There's great
people
that Trump might be connected, but, you know, why are we harping on Clinton here, you know? But
it's funny you bring up Nixon, because I was going to mention this earlier when you brought up Bohemian Grove, that I, you know, like a lot of people of my generation were introduced to Bohemian Grove via the internet with Alex Jones, remember, who broke into Bohemian Grove and claimed he had exposed the elites. And he had audio of Richard Nixon talking about Bohemian Grove. And he's someone who's, you know, told this story for decades. And I've been a huge critic of his. And I think he's problematic, to put it lightly. But ironically, a lot of the claims he made are, you know, shown in this Epstein story, but this is the one story he's rejected. He's really aligned with Trump's claim that there's nothing to see here.
Well, you know, but then why is that? And that's the other interesting thing, because the last thing, when you have a, what I think is now clearly a pretend democracy, what keeps it going is the sense that we have this side or that side. And what the Epstein case is, they're right in there in the same, you know, dump, you know, in the same cesspool, really. And what does distinguish themselves? And that was true on a lot of policy here. Certainly the embrace of finance, capitalism, and Wall Street's shenanigans and so forth. I mean, thoroughly bipartisan. And, you know, you think of, you go right down the line, the principal actors. And I guess, yes, when we had the old Bohemian Grove, most of us who were critical of it, or the Jonathan Club in L.A., or, you know, any of these places, you could say, well, that's the elite. And then we have the good Democrats, and they don't hang out there, right? They don't have their press conferences there, right? They go to the AFL-CIO meeting or whatever, you know. Well, that changed with the ultimate perversion of what is called the meritocracy. You know, okay, we admit other people in, but now you really have to convert and be one of us. And that means power for power's sake. It means virtue cleansing. We always know how to frame it properly. And in fact, Trump is a great, I don't know, we could end on this, but I think there's something, God, I'll never hear the end of saying this. I'm not apologizing for Trump, but there is something refreshing about his crudeness, about his bullying that, you know, and I think that's why he has so many critics, including in the establishment. He gives away too much. You know, he's blatant. And these guys really are absolutely brilliant, whether it was, you know, the Republicans or the Democrats or so forth, but they're absolutely brilliant at disguising the whole thing.
I totally agree with that. Yeah. That seeming authenticity.
You said, I do agree. You do agree?
Oh, yeah. I agree with, I think Trump's so able to
attack me. I'll say you, because if you say anything about this, well, of course, it's right now, the Democrat, we have to rally around the Democrats, because obviously Trump is, you know, proto-fascist. And I think people are going to have to face up to this, that this problem, you know, it really begins. Reagan might have been the vehicle, but he failed. He had the soybean loan scandal. He, you know, maybe had a little bit too much sincerity. He actually almost, you know, changed his view about Gorbachev and so forth. But with coming with Clinton really was the coming of the manipulators, these incredibly sophisticated people. And I keep bringing it back, maybe a last word about Lawrence Summers, because, you know, I think it says it all right there. Why was he rewarded with Harvard after destroying, you know, this New Deal, right? He was the prophet of it. And why? And then why did they think he would change his ways? No, they didn't. They thought he would bring in more money. Right, that was, by the way, Epstein's appeal, right? That he was connected with all these people.
Yeah, and he could get this money. And I think, you know, to your point about the kind of uniparty, that we kind of have this fake division amongst the parties. This is where I think we bring in also a question about the news media, because are these candidates in this era, you know, the Clinton or post-Clinton era, are these folks who have been or could be compromised? You know, the news media are really the ones who need to be asking that question. And the fact news media have been so hesitant to ask that question, also ask questions about what their role are in this, because Epstein was also a source for many press outlets as well. You know, the New York Times had some of those emails on their servers and did decide not to report on them. He got nice glowing profiles in places like Vanity Fair. So I think we also have to include a critique of the press here as well, because this information was not all hidden and just suddenly came out when this bill started getting discussed. A lot of these things have been out there previously, and the press theoretically could have reported that to the public.
Take that a little further, because this is what you're a true expert on. and we really have not discussed that. So let's go another few minutes on
because from my perspective, people in power abusing power is a story as old as time, right? You even talked about bankers in the Bible. That's a story as old as time. The press is supposed to be a major check on that. They're supposed to tell us the things that the powerful are doing. And if, you know, if the Epstein story is what it seemingly is turning into with every release, they've really dramatically failed at their job. Not just because they didn't uncover the story, which is a failure, but also because they had access to a lot of the people involved, a lot of the content. They were using Jeffrey Epstein as a source. There are claims that some of the critical reports of Epstein had been suppressed by some of the news outlets. They for years dismissed Jeffrey Epstein, tales of Jeffrey Epstein being a manipulator of those in power as conspiracy theories. So I think that the press has also played a critical role here, and that needs to be understood. And I think journalists out there right now who are going through these files need to understand that they have a constitutional responsibility to shine a light on as much of this as possible as soon as possible, because we're already too late in the game.
You know, it's a good point to end on, but, you know, it's central, I think, to the story, because the press definitely looked away from the very obvious cultural decadence that was involved. I mean, and it comes up in some of these terrific movies. It was actually first, you know, Oliver Stone, I have to give him credit, his first Wall Street, but he was not the only one. And there, mass media has gotten it right as a story in terms of not just documentaries, but some of these feature films about it. But the media somehow disconnected the idea of the drugs and the sex and everything from what was happening on Wall Street. But would it even have happened were people not on drugs or hooked on another drug, money or power or sex? Because after all, what are you doing? You're going to work. Let's just end with this, but think about that world of Lawrence Summers and Jeffrey Epstein. You're going to work. Now, you know, he worked for Dee Shaw building these things. He made, I don't know, $20 million at one point from this stuff, Lawrence Summers, so forth. And yet he had to go to Jeffrey Epstein to get $1 million for his wife's project or so forth. You know, so they're awash in this money, in this decadence. Now, if you're started out as a kind of liberal, enlightened person, you got to look around and say, what the hell am I doing here? You know, what is this world I've entered, right? You know, Bill Clinton, I'm a poor kid from Arkansas. What am I doing here? You know, I was supposed to make life better for people. Well, if you're sober, you might walk away from it. You might denounce it. You might be a whistleblower. You might challenge them, right?
Right.
How many whistleblowers were there? You know, very few. You know, I mean, I'm talking about through the agencies and all that they directed. No, clearly they decided this was a culture they were not going to expose because they were part of it. And that's the culture that allows the co-option of ideals, you know, and so forth. They could even get Jesse Jackson to back their bills. You know, that's what Lawrence Summers did and Bill Clinton, to back bills that ended up leaving black college graduates, who were one of the main targets, losing 70% of their wealth, and brown college graduates losing 60%, because Federal Reserve studies show that. You know, how do you sleep at night when you're party to this? Well, you better be high or obsessed with sex or on some escapist crazy world. And what's being exposed now, I'll just end on this, I'll let you have the last word if you want to, if you disagree. But to my mind, the story as it comes to be written, if we still have a world 20, 30 years from now, will be very much, like that tale of Roman decadence, that where it all comes apart. And that's what we're seeing through Epstein. We're seeing that degenerate stage of the Roman Empire, where all the power is used to just exploit people on the ugliest personal level and aggrandize your own power. But you probably have another larger goal in mind for your journalism here. What do you plan to show?
Well, I do remain hopeful. I think your critique of where the system is at and the brink that this corruption has brought us is totally accurate. I do though have faith in the American public that, you know, truth can be a great tool we can use to reassert democratic principles. But that's also why, to we talked about earlier, I think this story is so important. I think the public needs to understand how the system works, how this corruption becomes normalized, how power is utilized to leverage the system against itself, so we can hopefully create something alternative that doesn't allow it to happen again.
Great. So where do people read you? The Gaslight Gazette?
Yeah, I have a biweekly Substack at nolanhigdon.substack.com where I cover the latest fake news, censorship, character assassination, and the intersection of democracy and media, a lot of stuff on AI. And I also host the Disinfo Detox podcast where we take headlines, deconstruct them, look at what's true, what's false, what's misleading. And again, Bob, I just want to say thank you so much for all the work you've done over the years, and thanks for having me on the show.
I wish I'd had a better impact, but... I have to say, I actually believed, for all of its imperfections, I didn't get into journalism because I thought the end was here. I thought, you know, it could, but, you know, I really thought the system works. And I must say, I interviewed Bill Clinton before he was president. And, you know, I interviewed a lot of these people. I when I read the Epstein thing, I just, how did these people get into this? It, you know, I don't know. It's a discussion, I think, but it really asks you where are ethics, where's morality, where are your standards, what, you know, that's and why, by the way, let me be positive the way you were. It just was too much for Congress to look the other way. Suddenly, we do have separation of powers. Trump would have liked to bury it, right? There were probably.
Oh, absolutely.
Other top Democrats would like to bury it. Why are we belaboring this? And suddenly, you know, from the right and some of the left in the Congress said, you know, enough is enough and you can't cover this up. And there was a, you know, incredibly large veto-proof vote that said we have a right and need to see these files. And so I guess what I take away from what I've been trying to say, and I think we're in agreement on this. I don't think this should be trivialized. I don't think this should be dismissed as just some wild sex story, and rather should be thought of as maybe this is a fatal symptom of what is basically wrong with our society, which is the total corruption of power and the failure of any of those checks that we have been so proud of to have any effect. None of it seemed to matter.
Yeah, right. I think that's well said, and you know, I think it's well said and spot on. And during this year of corruption, I've talked a lot about how that this country desperately needs like a church committee type moment. I didn't think the Epstein story would be that moment, but it's starting to look that way, where Congress, in a bipartisan sense, is at least taking some of these story is serious, and some of the media are following as well. So that gives me a little bit of optimism, despite the dismantling of the system we discussed.
Okay, well, that's it for this issue of Sheer Intelligence. I want to thank Joshua Sheer, our executive producer, for putting this all together, and Diego Ramos, the managing editor of SheerPost.com. See you, I guess, in a couple of days, since I'm doing these things about 3-4 times a week. There's a lot to cover. See you then. Bye.